Welcome to the Plain Label Podcast, Pod Shots.
It's the same as Icon. You say to these butchers, you didn't want to share this world with us, then we don't have to share this world with you. There's legitimacy for this, am I correct? Ambushed and slaughtered again. While the rest of the world is playing games, Olympic torches and brass bands and dead Jews in Germany. And the world couldn't care less.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Podshots. I'm your host, Eric Williams. For this episode, we are discussing the 2005 film Munich. Written by Tony Kushner and Eric Roth, the film was based on the book Vengeance, the true story of an Israel counter-terrorist team by George Jones. The film stars Eric Bana and Daniel Craig and was directed by Steven Spielberg. Here to discuss the film with me is returning guest Mr. John Suntress.
How you doing, Eric?
Doing well. Before getting into our discussion, I would like to mention that this podcast is brought to you by the Deliberate Noise Network. Head over to deliberatenoise.com and check out some of the other shows that are over there. So, Mr. Suntress, it is the 11 o'clock comics slash around comics direct rip-off. Of a drink roll call. So what are you having for me drink wise?
Oh, I'm gonna disappoint you. I'm so sorry. had we done this two nights ago, I would be enjoying a local wine from a place called City Winery, which is a urban winery based in Chicago. Great music stage as well. They've got a few, I think, scattered across the United States. Hmm. And I have a bottle of one of their reds. I can't even identify if it's a Cabernet or a Pinot or whatever. But sadly, as I speak to you tonight, because I got a bit of a cold, it's all water.
All the H2O.
Michigan Straits.
Well, I am not disappointing. I am going with, which probably is one of my favorite wines. It is, it's a red blend, and so it's a little on the sweeter side. But it is from Dave Matthews of the Dave Matthews Band. It is a wine that he's involved with called The Dreaming Tree is the brand, and Crush is the specific wine that I'm drinking. And it's pretty good. It's kind of your not real heavy wine drinkers sort of a wine.
Cool.
And it's relatively inexpensive. It's like $10 to $12 a bottle. So it's not anything that's going to really hurt you on that end either.
Yeah, but those are like the best wines because, you know, they're affordable. And God, if you can find an affordable, good tasting wine, that's half the battle.
Yeah, there you go.
That's all the battle. Who am I kidding?
That's right. You know. That's right. Okay, well, let's go ahead and kick off our discussion of the 2005 film Munich.
Good afternoon. I'm speaking to you live just outside the Olympic Village in Munich, West Germany. At this moment, 8 or 9 athletes of the Israeli team are being held prisoner.
These guerrillas are a group called Black September.
And those have automatic weapons on the hostages.
A deal had been made.
Now the Israelis have disappeared.
Massive security forces
in front of an Arab protection.
They're all gone.
Every civilization finds it necessary to negotiate compromises with its own values.
We want to ask you, will you undertake a mission? You will have to leave the country and your family.
I can't live with refusing this.
We have 11 Palestinian names. Each had a hand in planning Munich. You're going to kill them, one by one. We deposit money into a box that doesn't exist.
200,000 for one name.
Am I alone?
You'll have 4 others. They know useful things like documents, cars, cleanup.
He gets in the bed, his weight arms the device.
I give a signal by switching off the light.
It's strange. You think of oneself as an assassin.
Think of yourself as something else, then.
What's wrong?
It should have exploded by now.
We found 3 more names for you.
You know how many laws we've broken.
He takes up the phone.
We hit the remote.
Hello. Hello.
We're supposed to be righteous. I lose that. That's my soul.
Dear Papa, don't forget my voice.
You think you can outrun your fears, your doubts?
And the IMDb plot synopsis of the film is as follows. And I give IMDb a hard time, but this one's actually not too bad. It goes like this. During the 1972 Olympic Games in Munich, 11 Israeli athletes are taken hostage and murdered by a Palestinian terrorist group known as Black September. Yep. In retaliation, the Israeli government recruits a group of Mossad agents to track down and execute those responsible for the attack. Sweet and simple.
Yes.
Most of the time on IMDb, you have this wordy bit of nonsense that goes on and on and on and over-explains. But that one's actually pretty good.
Yeah, that's the elevator pitch, I'm sure, that was, you know, brought to studio heads that said, yes, let's go with an adaptation of this book.
Yeah, they said Steven Spielberg, yes.
Well, that's, you know, honestly, this movie really fascinates me on a lot of levels because, as we talked about before we started recording, it is fair to categorize it as a depressing movie. But I find that it's an interesting movie on a lot of different levels. I think it's one of the most gritty Steven Spielberg movies that he's ever made.
It's a grown-up Spielberg movie.
It is a grown-up movie. And in fact, I would even take it a step further and say it's – and again, obviously, The Godfather is a classic, but in a lot of ways it seemed to be Spielberg's Godfather.
Mm.
Because it had a lot of organized crime, well, you know, it depends on your definition of terrorism, but I think it is as hard-hitting and goes behind the scenes of terrorism and counterterrorism as did Puzo and Coppola's Godfather. And I know that from a critical standpoint and even a factual standpoint, there are things that are missing in this film. But just taking it on its own merit – and also the fact that it was made 4 years after September 11th, mm-hmm. I think there are a lot of issues and things that they discuss in the film that could be applied to current terrorism. And it's for those reasons alone, and also an all-star, very great cast.
Yes.
I find it, like I said, I will continue, but I find it fascinating on just a bunch of levels.
Yeah, I think, and remind me to get back to the terrorism and the 9/11 parallels as we get farther into the discussion. But it's a film that I own, and it's you know, when we had talked about doing this movie, I was kind of like, well, yeah, I own that. I've seen Munich a few times. Then when I'm watching it, and I'm like, God, I don't remember this part that well, or I don't remember this very well either. And so I think it's one where I watched it, and I think I watched it fairly soon after it came out on DVD because I know that I didn't go see it in the theater.
Okay.
And I really enjoyed it, but I think I maybe had watched it once since to where I felt like I didn't know if I necessarily needed to revisit it. And it's a little bit like United 93.
Isn't that what I can appreciate that, and I still haven't seen United 93. I'm really not a September 11th film a person that pursues it just because, I mean, it was so tragic and I didn't know anyone personally that was lost, but I had friends that did. And also I just felt we were so, you know, it was so in our faces those first days after it happened, as it should have been. It was that kind of story and it was that kind of tragedy. But that it really, I still even now, you know, more than 10 years later, I don't look forward. I don't look for those kinds of films. So I still haven't seen United 93. I haven't seen the Nick Cage fireman movie that he made.
Oh, World Trade Center, the Oliver Stone film. Yeah,
exactly. There you go. And there, you know, I mean, that's the thing. And I forget who made United 93.
I believe it was Paul Greengrass. Is that right?
Oh, awesome. Okay. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, you know, really good filmmakers tackling these subjects. Conversely, Munich, I was 7 years old when the 72 Olympics happened and this story broke. Mm. And I think the film does a very good job in its first few minutes showing the ABC footage of the Olympics, the sportscaster Jim McKay suddenly thrust in the role as a newscaster in a way that I don't think any other sportcaster has. The closest I can think of is Al Michaels during the San Francisco
earthquake. Yes, yes.
But that doesn't compare to the tragedy of, you know, what happened at Munich, and also the political implications of it as well. And no one really knowing, much like a terrorist attack today, what's going to happen next. They do a great job of showing that footage. And I, like I said, was 7 years old, so I knew something was wrong because of the way they were covering it. But being a 7-year-old kid, I really didn't understand what was happening other than there was a hostage situation, and certainly didn't understand the politics. I think this film, in another comparison, I mentioned Godfather, I would say people who like Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy would find it interesting because it's the Middle Eastern espionage version of a story like that. That, sure. you know, I mean, again, it's kind of a contemporary to Tinker, Tailor in some ways, but the geopolitics are different. And the way the Mossad operates is very different from the way MI6 or the CIA operate. You get a sense of that a bit in the film itself. And I mean, that's the thing. I think it's an interesting look inside this world, and also the feeling that, much like a good war movie, that these are just people that find themselves in incredible situations. Mm. And I think this one to be, to have this revenge squad covertly going after, you know, the Black September. Black September, is that the name of the?
Black September, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and again, I mean, I think it's amazing. I think it's something we always hear about. We hear about dirty tricks and dirty secret wars and things like that. And Spielberg really puts you on the front line of that kind of, you know, battle. And yeah. several kind of attacks. And I think it's incredibly visceral, as much as Private Ryan was. And that's why, yeah, I mean, I think it's worthy of study and especially the people that reflexively will think of Steven Spielberg as the Hallmark card of movie directors and feel good movies and E.T. and all that stuff is great. It is. I don't mean to dismiss it, but it is, I mean, I think it's these kinds of films where you really see a filmmaker doing something they want to do, and also really the fearlessness to make it as gritty as it was. I saw it in the theater.
Okay.
And I made the accident of taking a couple of my elderly aunts with us. We saw it like Christmas Day night.
Mm.
Or New Year's Day night. Or it was literally 10 years around this time. It was, in our family, sometimes it's a tradition after the big meal, do we want to go see a movie? And I just kind of threw it out there. And a lot of the younger family members are like, you know, that were in their 20s and early 30s. They were like, yeah, let's go see it. And the elderly aunts wanted to go as well. And I, you know, we came out. Oh my God, that was horrible. That's not a Christmas movie.
Yeah, it definitely isn't.
No, it isn't. But, it was, I'm like, sorry, I just knew it was going to be this cool, intense film, and it was. And I felt bad about their experience, but I was really impressed with the film.
Yeah, I was really struck by the promotional material involved, because I distinctly remember seeing this trailer and seeing Eric Bana staring at the lamp, and seeing the I think it's either the second or third hotel bombing, the second hotel bombing, I believe. And seeing that and seeing just different clips of the film and not having the sort of feel of a Spielberg film while just watching the trailer, like, ooh, this is something different. You know, watching it going, well, this is Steven Spielberg, but this, you can tell just from the promotional material that it's not the same Steven Spielberg.
Well, yeah. And yeah. Again, I mean, the timing right after September 11th, when terrorism is on everyone's minds, mm-hmm. I just thought it was so bold to present a, if not sympathetic, even-handed portrayal of this issue on both sides. Yeah, I just think it really was this very serious, very violent.
Mm-hmm.
Very compelling film that, like I said, just worked on so many levels. And I honestly think it's one of Eric Bana's best films.
Yeah, I would say so. I would say so. I think he I don't know that he's ever presented with material that's this challenging.
Agreed.
You know, I feel like I feel like casting directors are a little short-sighted with him.
Yeah, because I think honestly, and maybe it's a guilty pleasure with us geeks, but Time Traveler's Wife, I thought he got to do a lot of things finally after being just pretty boy leading man.
Yeah, you know, I mean, we've done that. We did. It was actually a month where we had in that month we had Ron Richards on the show. Talking about time travel movies, and we did The Time Traveler's Wife. But that was much better than expected. I watched it for the first time for the show.
Okay.
But yeah, I was like, this is kind of okay.
Yeah, no, there's a definite,
so bad.
There was a style to the filmmaking, and yeah, I mean, it worked for Hulk that I think Banner comes off very cold in that film. I had seen him in Troy. And I forget which Greek he plays in Troy, and shame on me being Greek. but I, you know, and even, Funny People as, husband, Judd Apatow's real, wife.
Leslie Mann.
Yeah, Leslie Mann's husband in Funny People. He's, I think, pretty good as a left field, you know, kind of jerk boy, you know, husband, boyfriend, whatever.
Yeah, and he had the sort of forgettable Star Trek reboot appearance as well.
Oh yeah, yeah, but I loved him as Nimoy, and I you know, hello Christopher. I mean, it was just he was fine, and it was, I mean, obviously unrecognizable in all the Romulan look and
sure.
Shit and everything.
Mm-hmm.
But I think he's great. The surprisingly empty performance I think in Munich is Daniel Craig.
Yeah, pre-Bond, Daniel Craig.
Right, just before Casino Royale, if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. Didn't Casino Royale also come out in like 05 or something?
Yeah, I believe that's correct.
Probably November of 05, and I think Munich came out.
Yeah, 05, Casino Royale is 06.
Oh, so there you go. Okay, yeah, that makes sense then.
Yeah, so there you go. But yeah, it was kind of surprising because he's very not Bond-like. You know, when you look on it and you're like, okay, well, he looks about the same age as he was when he first, you know, became James Bond, but he's very, very, he's clearly much different in terms of the characters, you know, and he's still Daniel Craig and he still has some of the Daniel Craig tics and
yes.
You know, you have to focus on the blue eyes, of course, it's an interesting performance. I think that, his character, I don't know that his character really gets a chance to be fleshed out that much in this.
I was gonna say the same thing. No, I think Ciarán Hinds.
Ciarán
Hinds
from Rome.
Yeah, I think he gets a very nuanced performance. They're part of Banna's terrorist crew that we get to know a little bit better. The bomb specialist, and I forget his name, but I think he obviously gets a lot to do. But yeah, Craig pretty much is just steely-eyed South African Jewish killer.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much it.
Yeah. Going back to the beginning of the film, I wanted to ask you something about this is, you know, you mentioned the choice to use actual footage and to sort of blend that with the movie making of the break-in and that sort of thing. What did you make of the beginning not showing the whole story and just waiting to sort of slow roll what happens to, or actually seeing what happens to the hostages? Like, do you like that to where, you know, later in towards the end of the film, we get to see what happens in those helicopters, and we get to see that the execution of them? We're told at the beginning that they are dead. But you don't actually see it, and you just kind of get it slowly doled out throughout the film in Banna when he finally is able to relax a little bit or finally fall asleep. What did you make of that?
Well, I think it's kind of, again, if you were of that era that remembers that moment in history, that's what we saw. Mm-hmm. So if anything, I think it brought the audience all up to date in with what they needed to know to move forward. I don't think we needed all those facts yet because I don't think the Mossad had all those facts right away either. And so I think it was okay to do it that way. And if anything, it informed the uninformed and it gave them a chance to catch up. And it reminded us, kind of like seeing, you know, Armstrong footage of landing on the moon.
Sure.
I mean, and especially, you know, coming from sports radio, that Olympics because of the dark side of it and also – the as a sports broadcaster, the performance of Jim McKay,
mm-hmm.
it stands out, and it is something. It's an important footnote in sports broadcasting. And Jim McKay was a classy guy, and all buttoned down professional, just wonderful broadcaster, really, till he retired. And really, you know, again, so that's kind of why. I think he very succinctly gave all the facts that we had at the moment. And really the world was watching his information as we were getting it. So I think it kind of worked in the narrative.
Okay.
That way.
Yeah, I can see that. I also really particularly liked how in this time, I think that, you know, modern day gets such a bad rap for this, especially with the 24-hour news cycle. But at the time, it was about who was first, not who was right. Right? Because the misinformation of who survived and who didn't survive.
True.
Because, you know, it's initially, oh, well, the nine hostages, they're fine. Two of them died.
That's right. That's right.
And then immediately after, it's like, no, they're all gone.
Well, you know, again, yeah, it was, yeah, and I don't think it was a rush to be first, but I do, and I think if anything, it was a rush for good news because, God, I know, in documentaries about the incident, literally, you know, parents were watching, not sure what happened to their kids. I mean, there was one weightlifter in particular that was from the United States that obviously, you know, could claim dual citizenship and weightlift for the Israeli team. And it was such an achievement for him to make the team and you know, it's such good feelings. And again, the parents were of that World War II generation.
Right.
So, you know, there is that unease of going back to Germany and, so soon in their own lives after the war. Yeah. So I don't know. I never heard McKay talk about the misinformation that was initially reported and finally, you know, so I don't know.
Yeah. It just is reminiscent to me of it.
I can appreciate that. You know what I mean? And certainly compared to what we get today, I can see that point of view. I guess I didn't take it that way because I had seen, you know, I remembered it a bit as a kid and had seen a few documentaries about the incident itself before seeing Munich. And that's what really intrigued me to finally see Munich. And really what I always focus on and even rewatching it more was, the way the Mossad worked, the structure, the way that, again, there, I think espionage fans would appreciate, learning how things worked in that pre-connected world.
Sure.
Communication worked, how you know, not only information, but assignments were passed on and executed, to also not only get the job done, but to be able to have this, line of deniability should any moment, you know, get caught. There is one thing, and I'm guessing you might have come across it as well in your, research for the film, comparing it to the real incident, where the film does fall short. There was an incident in Lillehammer where a Moroccan waiter was mistaken for a PLO and was assassinated and was a total innocent. And, the people that caused that crime were captured in Norway and tried. And it was because of that, that the Mossad and the Israelis stopped doing these counterterrorism revenge missions. Because, you know, they actually had collateral damage that was proven, and it was a huge embarrassment for the Israelis and the Mossad, and they really had no choice. And it was really that made them stop, and it wasn't the actions of Banna's group.
Yeah, it wasn't Avner who you know, had a conscience. I think that, for me, I think that's a lot harder to fit into the narrative about Avner.
No question.
You know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. No, and it's... You know, this is the struggle with historical fiction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's that line. And I do think that most people are reasonable enough to separate fact from fiction. But, you know, every now and then, and I know this in sports radio, even dealing with sports biography movies where someone will quote a scene from a film and go, well, that's obviously the way it happened. And in fact, Cinderella Man, the Ron Howard film, I really took exception with some of the choices that Ron Howard made and got into, I wasn't able to talk to him directly, but our morning show had Ron on and Howard was really cool about it. And not jerky about it, or it didn't seem to be angry that, you know, we had this point. But, you know, Max Baer is made out to really be an ass.
And a killer.
And yeah, and well, he unfortunately did fight two guys that ended up dying in the ring,
sure, after,
you know, from injuries that he gave. So technically, he did kill one, if not two. There
sure
is one that they linked directly to Max, and the second one, they're like, yeah, it was unfortunately probably the beating that Max gave this guy. That, you know, it was the second guy.
It's also the performance though that makes him seem joyous and enjoy.
Yeah,
you know.
Well, and it flies in the face of hundreds of minutes of newsreel footage and radio and TV in the 50s. But in the 30s, I mean, Max Baer was like one of the nicest, funniest, friendliest sportsmen of his era. And he just didn't take Braddock seriously. And that's why he lost. He didn't train for it. Whereas Braddock trained as hard as he could because it was literally the fight of his life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing. It doesn't minimize Braddock's accomplishment. And I even, you know, made sure that the morning hosts were like, hey, the Depression is the bad guy. You know, the social economic circumstances of the 30s, that's the bad guy. You don't need, you know, a black hat and a mustache on Max Baer to tell a good story. And I don't remember Ron's exact words, but he, you know, well, I get that, but, you know, this is a movie and it's entertainment. And again, it's, you know, yeah. So, and again, with Munich, it would be complicated to kind of explain that. And it's not the kind of thing you might have been able to throw something in, I guess, in the same postscript when they keep talking about the fates of, you know, the members of Black September and everything. But,
yeah.
Whatever. I mean, you know, it is, again, and that's why just judging it based on the movie itself and as something, you know, it's funny because, like, we're both saying, I like the movie. Mm. Probably I'm going to take a sip of water.
Sure.
Yeah, we're both saying I like the movie and yeah, but I mean, you know, it's like, boy, it was great. You know, like I said, the feel good hit of 2005. It is. It's an intense, complicated movie, but I think it inspires discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's great. I mean, that's what great art should do, is make you want to talk about it afterwards. And I think Munich achieves that.
Yeah. One of the things that I thought was interesting and, is pretty, a pretty small thing in the scheme. I mean, not getting into the political discussion and the terrorism, that sort of thing yet, but it's the getting the band together scene. You know, I mean, we've seen this sort of thing hundreds of times, right?
Sure.
You and I have read how many issues of Avengers where it does something like this, right?
Yeah.
So putting the team together. And here it's already together. You don't see in a lot of modern films, you would see like each of them at doing their expertise and then, you know, getting a phone call and meeting somewhere at a warehouse. You would see something along those lines,
right,
typically.
Right.
Here they're all together. They don't know each other really.
Right.
And they're all kind of happy-go-lucky about it. Like, they're joking and laughing, and there's a serious tone to it all, but they are trying to cut through that tension, and they are, you know, trying to not be so morose about what they're out to do, and that really was, that really, like, disarmed me. I was thinking like, oh man, this is going to be so intense. It's going to be so serious. And it's, you know, you look at the runtime and you're like, whoa, it's going to be serious for almost 3 hours. This is going to be quite a thing to chew on. But I was kind of surprised at the small amounts of levity in the film. And I think that it does a good job of letting you release a little bit of that tension that you're feeling.
Yeah, it's a more realistic, I think, portrayal, because I do think, just as human beings, to get through such tough things, you will kind of, you know, seek out any funny moment just to kind of relieve tension. But also, I think, as the film goes on too, you see that, yeah, these guys are experts in air quotes, but also they are and they aren't. And mm-hmm. and unfortunately they're, flaws come back to haunt them at certain points in the film. And also, like a good war movie too, you'll get some people that might be a little more, like, I think a lot of them were feeling national pride, and this was an opportunity to kind of right the scales. And then as they, you know, assignments got murkier and murkier, and also whatever the results were from their assignments, they weren't sure. I mean, certainly Banna just wasn't convinced that, you know, he was doing the right thing. And I think it could be said for the others as well. And that their momentary failures on various missions, I think, went to haunt them because lives were at stake. You know, and then on the other side, God, my favorite scene, and I had remembered it from my first viewing. Cause like you, I really only saw it, I think I've only seen it two or three times total.
Yeah.
And the last time was right before us doing this conversation. When they're in a safe house and the other terrorist cell has also, rented the same safe house. And essentially you've got, you know, enemies sharing a safe house as neutral ground because they're both tired and they weren't, they, you know, not enemies per se, but really like terrorists on very different missions, basically that, you know, it could have ended a lot scarier and more frightening. And instead becomes this very human moment of almost, dare I say it, like a spring break moment where you've got like 10 guys in a room.
Yep. And you have the dick measuring with the radio.
Exactly. Yeah, and you're getting either real Persian sounding music or really Israeli sounding music. Actually, it was never on Sunday that they were playing. And finally, it's Daniel Craig is the peacemaker. It's like, here, rock and roll. We all like rock, right?
Yeah.
And it's great, and it's a great silent scene, like you said, and it really is. No, this is our turf. No, it's our turf. And it's like, it's neutral ground. Let's all just try and get along. And it's played great and very funny scene.
Yeah, when we have, you know, I'm thinking about heroes and the sort of types that Spielberg tends to have in a lot of his films. And while there are some things that, you know, are mainly coincidence with this film that are the same as other Spielberg works, where it's the, you know, the father that's not around, abandoning your family, that sort of thing, that's prevalent in most of Spielberg's works with the, you know, it's either a divorced family or the dad's not around, certainly.
True.
To where here, like you were mentioning, these are not all experts, and we do get a little bit of a, like a hero's journey type with Avner for a while.
No question.
You know, because we have that first death scene and they're both uncomfortable and they don't know what to do, and the guy's kind of shushing him and pushing his gun down, and him and the bomb expert, I think it's Robert.
Yeah, Robert was, yeah, I don't remember the actor's name, but
it's Matthew, Matthew Kasovitz, maybe? I don't know.
Okay. I hadn't seen him in other things, but I thought he was great. It's these, like you said, it's these ordinary people. And that's the thing, like when you were saying before that we would likely see them in their field of expertise before they put the crew together. That's Mission Impossible and S.H.I.E.L.D. and, you know,
team.
and James Bond and stuff. You know, let's get, you know, Rex, whatever. He's a demolition expert and a, you know, lover of fine wines and women and globetrotting, you know, whatever.
It's like your Ocean's 13, your Italian jobs, your, you know, whatever.
And you're right. And those are even better examples of even more plain clothes, but still slick guys. Whereas this is Shmuel, the grocer, who nobody knew, but by the way, you know, used to be in the Israeli army and, you know, knows how to blow shit up.
Right.
You know, it's like, okay, all right, that's fine. And I think that makes it much more interesting because they struggle. They struggle with trying to do these things, both from just actually the mechanics of getting it done and the morality issues as well. I think it makes it such an interesting film. God, when they all dress up as women.
Oh, yes. When they have that huge crew of people.
Right. And it does. And it looks like this kind of almost goofy thing. And they're giddy as they're getting dressed, you know, to kind of, you know, make this waterfront hit. But, and it starts off almost like a frat party or whatever.
And yeah. I guess I have a question about that. Do you think that everyone in the five, isn't it five of them to begin with? I believe. Yes. Do you think that all of them know what's going on? Because I felt like in that scene that they weren't all completely sure as to why some of the guys were dressing up like women.
Right, right. Well, no, and that's, and again, that's why it's like, it's not a slick operation. There are moments of confusion. And again, it kind of informs even Bana saying, I don't even know if we're killing the right people. And like, how do I know this is connected to what you want us to do, when he asks Jeffrey Rush? And he's like, because we're telling you to, and or because I'm your boss. He's like, you're not my boss. I pay you. And he's like, you don't pay me. A mailbox pays.
The box pays me. Yeah.
Right. And it's true. That kind of leads to Bana's, you know, questions of conscience in terms of, okay, now here's another job. I'm like I really think a lot of these guys took this assignment as a finite assignment.
Mm-hmm.
Not realizing A, how long it was going to take, and that these other jobs would pop up. And it's like, well, what does this, what does X have to do with Y?
Mm-hmm. Well, so, you know, especially once they get into the section of, well, this is the guy that replaced the other guy, so we need to get rid of him too. You know, this is the new guy that replaced the person that you killed, so he needs to go. And that's when you get into the real life parallels of 9/11 and what followed. And you're like,
right.
Like, wow, this is, you know, that's when for me, I'm like, oh, this is making me uncomfortable. This is making me feel uncomfortable.
Well, yeah. And again, yeah, these are those parallels. And like, you know, World War II movies, nobody replaced Hitler.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's the thing. Hitler, Tojo, Mussolini. It's like, no, that guy went and things changed.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that kind of clear cut, you know, black and white conflict doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
And really, it's why in the modern day, the post 9/11 reaction to terrorism, and this is my own point of view, did kind of trouble me, because I felt that we had experienced several decades, at least going back to the 70s, if not earlier, of terrorist attacks, not on our soil, not as many people. I appreciate all of that. But when you get right down to it, and that's why I think Munich, again, is an interesting film. It shows terrorism. And granted, it's happening, you know, through the 70s and early 80s, the period I think that Munich covers and everything. But
mm-hmm.
You can relate to it, because I don't think the game has changed that much. Mm-hmm. And that's why I was a little disappointed at some of the crowd mentality or reaction to 9/11. And I felt that the people of Great Britain had it much better, or not better, but at least understood what was going on a little bit more when the subway bombings happened in England.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. A couple of years, like around 2006 or 2007. And I remember I tell these guys that Paul Jenkins had a panel at Wizard World Chicago at the comic convention of comic writers, and Rucka was on it, and Brubaker was on it. I believe Brian Bendis was also on it. Paul was the moderator, and Rucka was even saying that he had seen footage of, you know, people's reactions to the bombing. And this old senior citizen, very angry, is like, I've been bombed by bigger and badder people than these idiots. Mm. You know, I'm not going to be intimidated. And I just wanted to see more of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I know those people exist out there, but we didn't get to, and for whatever reasons, the news channels of today, I think, really kind of spent too much time on the tragedy and not more on the, hey, you know, all right. Guess what? You know, they made the wrong move, and I don't want to get into politics, but yeah, just,
of course, sure.
Just a little more of a spine. And I do think that a lot of Americans had after 9/11 of, okay, you want to mess with us? All right. You're going to be sorry.
Yeah.
And we're not, and also we're not afraid of you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, because this stuff is going to go on. And I mean, and that's, again, the message of the film is that, you know, despite this good mission that Bana and his crew thought they were taking with the best of intentions, the reality is, no, the fight's always going to go on. There's always going to be somebody replacing.
Yeah.
And there's always going to be another dirty job that has to get done.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's again, it shows the futility, and it makes us all step back. And then now it's time for a discussion. Well, is this the, you know, counterterrorism doesn't seem to be the solution, right?
Or right.
Wrong? And what is? Not what is.
Exactly. Yeah, one of the other things, getting back to the Spielberg-isms, is, you know, he's a guy who gets a bad rap for his scripts at times, where they're, you know, overly sentimental. Have your cutesy lines in there. And so there's one part where Abner, Eric Bana's character, is talking to his wife, and he says that you're the only home I ever had. Which in any other Spielberg movie, that would be greeted with swelling music and, you know, close-ups on faces and single tears. And in this instance, his wife laughs at him and says that that's such a corny line.
Yep.
And I loved that because of the filmmaker.
Yes.
If that's just anybody, I'm like, okay, well, that's, I agree that I don't know that I would say that to someone that sounds like a movie script line.
Agreed. And again, I think, the lack of music throughout the movie.
Yes.
It's a very realistic movie. Another modern comparison could be Zero Dark Thirty.
Yes.
Because it has that kind of, you're in the room with these people as this happens. There's just this level of realism in the filmmaking that you don't expect from Spielberg. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's a great piano player suddenly whipping out a guitar and doing an amazing, you know, rock lick. And you're like, wait, but this guy's known for piano playing. What the hell's going on? And that's the thing. Like, the people that, you know, dismiss Spielberg, Hitchcock went through the same thing. It's like, you don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Like, these guys are geniuses at their craft. And Spielberg really is a genius. And it's awesome that he can challenge himself. And even, you know, the audience and stuff. And I mean, that's the thing. Like, I think from a critical response, this film got like as many good reviews as, you know, tepid reviews. I don't think it got out and out bad reviews.
No, it got good reviews. It was nominated for 5 Oscars. It didn't win.
Right. I remember that.
But yeah, I mean, it's, you know, its Metacritic score is 74 out of 100, which is good.
That's cool. Okay, yeah. That's excellent. Well, and I know, like, you know, when I was reading up on it too, Ebert, you know, had it on his top list of 2005 films. Mm-hmm. I was reading some of the people not in that 70%+ that was favorable, and some of their little, you know, critiques here and there. And also the fact that it is one of the, you know, less grossing Spielberg films. That's okay. I mean, I don't think it is meant for a mass audience. I think it is meant to be really looked at, and also to look at, you know, and God, all of a sudden I'm doubting myself. He made Schindler's List, obviously.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, Schindler's List. And
well, you know, I mean, that's what, oh yeah, is there another kind of powerful, oh, well, Color Purple, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, and he, we did this show not too long ago also, but he did AI.
Sure.
Which is a movie that I remember completely dismissing at first, and watching it again, and then watching it for this podcast, and just loving it.
And wow, I don't know if I could bring myself to watch it again, but go on. I'll tell you what I think of AI. Well, I don't mean it really. I'll explain myself.
Yeah, it's just you know, getting through it, and you know, obviously noting all of the Pinocchio parallels clearly, and when you get to the end, and it being about religion in my mind.
Sure.
And just loving. You know, because much like the political discussions, I love having the film create discussion about religion. I don't like talking religion, but I like having the discussion about a film that is talking about it, if that makes sense.
I understand. I'll give you another left field curveball, and that's, you know, that's what I love about Star Trek Deep Space Nine, is its overall discussion of religion as a concept.
Sure.
And how society reacts to religion. But for me, AI was fascinating because it started with Kubrick and ended with Spielberg. And it's interesting watching another guy put on the other guy's suit and walk around and, okay, I'm going to adhere to some things that Kubrick laid out. But at the end of the day, he still has to be his own filmmaker. So for me, it didn't matter if it succeeded or failed. The exercise of watching Spielberg go through this film and the choices he made, which was just interesting, or even just the way that it spilled out. You know, it literally felt like one artist started a painting and the other artist finished it. And it's like, you look for the differences and, you know, you wonder. And then again, the discussions it inspired in me and my friends was, do you think Kubrick would have done that? Or,
yeah.
You know, what, you know, where is this? Is this still Kubrick or is this Spielberg's, you know, well, I see the outline going left. I'm going to go right.
Yeah. We talked a bit about that, about how, you know, everyone seems to think that the beginning and the end is Spielberg and the middle of the gritty part is Kubrick. But, it, you know, according to what they say, and, you know, who knows if they're saying this just to say this, but the more sentimental parts were Kubrick and him saying that he couldn't make them work in the script. So he wanted Spielberg, who would know how to handle those sort of things, to do it right.
That's almost what I think, because I think we would have gotten those same scenes, but they would have been a lot more clinical and antiseptic and not as warm.
Yeah.
As they were in the finished product. And again, you know, that's the thing. That's where Spielberg gets attacked, is warm and fuzzy. He's mm-hmm. too warm and fuzzy. Now, there ain't much warm and fuzzy in Munich.
No, there's not in Saving Private Ryan, really, either. You
know, right. Well, that, and that's true, too. But even Private Ryan has that – I'd have to hear an Israeli and what they thought of Munich. Mm-hmm. I'd like to see more of an Israeli point of view, because at the end of the day, I do still think Private Ryan had at its core – the good war, the way Americans feel about World War II.
Interesting. Interesting. You know, my dad, who's a Vietnam vet and was a Marine in Vietnam, he, Saving Private Ryan is the only movie that he stopped watching with me.
Interesting.
That he watched it, and that storming, you know, Normandy, the beach was too real, too much. And so he said right then, he's like, I'm not watching it.
You're right.
If the rest of this movie's like this, he's like, I'm not going to be able to handle it.
But that's the thing. It wasn't. I didn't feel it was. Mm. I mean, you still see moments of the horrors of war throughout the film. But for me, it is that he still needed to put that tag at the end of Private Ryan of, what's his face? His character,
Of Private Ryan, of Matt Damon?
Yeah, right. Matt Damon. Exactly. Yeah, Private Ryan. Tell me I'm a good man. Tell me I was a good man. Yeah. And, you know, and it's like, all right, here's our Hallmark card. Thank you, Stephen. you know, again, you don't get that in Munich. Things aren't tied up in a pretty bow at the end.
That's true. Yeah.
And that's where I think, I just think that was really pleasantly surprising. And that's the thing. I do think that, Spielberg has those moments. Minority Report, I think he, you know, showed some good dark moments in that people weren't expecting.
Yeah.
And again, he's a fascinating filmmaker. And I think if you're really looking at his work, you have to look at, this. And that's why I mentioned specifically Schindler's List more so than Private Ryan, in that I would like to know the Jewish perspective.
Mm.
And on this, and to be honest, the PLO perspective as well.
Sure.
Because I do think that he is reasonably even-handed in the terrorism and the counterterrorism portrayals. Some of the critics gave him crap for that. I think it just kind of opens the discussion more, because I do think that you just hear these stories all the time. You hear this about World War I and World War II. About soldiers that literally were, you know, now it's a cliche, just following orders. And I don't mean the horrible things, but literally those guys like you see in Munich that are really just man against man in the moment of, you know, a move. I'm not talking about, you know, prisoner of war camps or any disgusting crimes against humanity, but literally just that, all right, you've got two sides and they're out on the field of battle. Someone's not coming out of this alive. And, you know, I'm sure there are a lot of people, much like Banna, that regret pulling triggers that had to do it and stuff. And I think it's a great, you know, portrayal of both sides, and that, yeah, these are just people that are in bad circumstances and really following the wishes of others, because that's the only way they can make money, a sense of national pride, a sense of religious pride or whatever. It's complicated. And I think, you know, what makes us do terrible things is as fascinating as what makes us do good things.
Yeah. And I do love, like I mentioned earlier, the sort of slow, I love how he slowly sort of delves into just putting his head down and doing what he's supposed to do, and being okay with killing for a while.
Yeah, for a while.
You know, because he's got the guy at gunpoint, like I said, and he was all nervous about it. Well, then he, you know, they're about to blow up the guy's phone that's on the phone, and his daughter comes and answers the phone. Right? And so they're panic stricken about that, about is the daughter going to accidentally get blown up? And, you know, she doesn't. But later in the film, they're talking about how there's going to be casualties, and Avner's not concerned. You know, he's like, he's basically saying they're there to kill the person. They don't care.
Right. Right.
What else happens?
Well, he's accepted his job at that point.
Mm-hmm.
The one scene that, forgive me, go on and then I'll ask.
Oh, I was going to say, I did want to talk about stick with the realism of Spielberg and get into the hotel bombing sequence where the bomb is too big.
Uh huh.
Yep. And we have, you know, of course we have the humanity of getting to meet the guy and getting to see the people on the other side, and the woman's, you know, blinded. But I mean, for me, even knowing that that's coming, that's scared me every time when that bomb goes off.
Sure.
But you know, just the sound design of it all, but that has made me jump every time. And I think that is such an achievement to have on screen that sequence, because just the logistics of making that set to look that way, and to have him stumbling through there. I mean, I'm watching that going, Jesus, because you know that it's not like it's all CG, you know, it's not,
sure.
It's all, you know, it's, I would imagine it's all practical. And so just, that part astounds me every time I see it, to where I'm just kind of dumbfounded whenever that part comes on. I'm like, oh, I'm ignoring the narrative for the moment. I'm just in awe of the way that this looks.
Absolutely. I can appreciate that. Yeah. I also think that, like, explosions and gunshots and car crashes are so omnipresent in all media, dramatic media, that we do get desensitized. And
sure,
that
yeah.
when you do show some sort of destruction that, you know, isn't your typical kind of, all right, here we go again, that is impressive. So, mm-hmm. you know, both from a technical standpoint and the impact of the moment as well, that it isn't a moment that you're expecting to feel like, oh, God, they are getting it. Oh, no, wait a minute. And yeah. then, you know, then like you said, the collateral damage and stuff, it's like, holy cow.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to ask about the scene with the arms dealer, the French arms dealer.
Oh, with Louis.
Yeah.
Louis and Papa.
Yes, and Papa in particular, because that's another scene that people kind of point to and say, yeah, that's not that realistic. And it's like, that's the one, I wouldn't call it a flaw, but interesting choice of Spielberg's, where I do think he gets a little preachy and allows the romance of the moment, and not romance might be the wrong word, but kind of a story, a kind of cliche story moment. I mean, I do think that there are arms dealers around like this. It was very much like an organized crime moment.
Do you mean when he visits the house? Is that?
And he goes they have the outside dinner and everything. Yeah. And they get to the discussion. And at the end, he tells them, he goes, you know, you could have been my son, but you're not my son.
Mm-hmm.
And 'cause they like it. He almost seems to, they almost come to an understanding. It ends with the coldness of, by the way, we're still in the, you know, you're buying arms from me. Don't get too close to me, because if I got to kill somebody, I will, you know, you're gone.
Yeah, I did have in my notes, I wondered what the reason for that sequence was specifically, because
that's,
you know, for a film that is, you know, 2 hours and 40 minutes long, I was like, is this really necessary? Is this really something
right.
that's moving it forward? I guess the only thing I took from it is maybe that gives Louis a little bit of, it looks like he has a little bit of disdain for Avner after that, because it looks like his dad does tend to favor him. You know, they seem to be simpatico.
But Papa immediately reminds him that if I got to choose between you and my son, I'm choosing my son.
Yeah.
So I understand that. Yeah, I guess that gives Louis a little bit of something to kind of burn on. But we and Avril or whatever his name is.
Avner.
Because it's funny. I know a Jewish man named Avram and a lot of like derivatives that are not quite.
Think of
Avner.
The phony baseball inventor, Avner.
Exactly, yeah, but it's V instead of V.
So
if it was Avner, I'd be all over it. I can handle Avner. I think it just felt kind of like a scripty moment rather than a realistic moment. Although it reminded me, and when you said that, you know, in that long of a movie, do we need this scene? it reminded me of Apocalypse Now redone, or Redo, however you say it.
Yeah, Redux, yeah.
Redux!
You gotta say like...
I like Redux!
You gotta say it like you're in the Midwest of North America.
Yeah, there's ducks, and now we're gonna Redux it. That's right. But yeah, that scene at the French plantation,
yeah.
That's in Vietnam and everything, and they have that kind of dinner conversation. It reminded me a lot of that.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think you're far off there at all. I do have, you mentioned this earlier, the sort of safe house and the confrontation there and how about how we see these players later when they're after the main black hat that they're after.
Uh-huh.
I do think that from that section on, for a good maybe half hour or so, it is a little tough to follow narratively. Because I feel like I'm not exactly sure, and I think that is the point, because that's when we're starting to get into terrorism and who can you trust and who's actually right. Who's actually
the bad guy here.
Yeah, who's the bad guy? Because we have the U.S. that's stopping this guy from being killed, and we have, all sides are seeming to play against each other. And so while I think that that works, I think that it is done in a way where it makes it complicated to follow.
I would agree. No, I would agree. And that's the thing. I mean, this period of time, all of a sudden, after years of 100-minute movies, and I always cynically believe that movies were made to be an hour and 40 minutes long because they'd fit so nicely in a commercial 2-hour time slot.
Yeah.
In the pre-cable dominant days that we now have with movies, that filmmakers and studios got almost overindulgent and allowed a lot of films to be longer than they needed to be. And I don't know who's going to say to Spielberg, yeah, you really need to cut this 20 minutes or whatever. In fact, I feel that way currently about Birdman.
Interesting. I know a lot of people that loved it. And I appreciated it, but I just did not connect with it.
I felt the same way.
I just couldn't latch onto it.
I don't know if I'd say maybe you're right. I guess it is connect with it because I didn't buy the director's general thesis or whatever he felt, I can say this because obviously like a lot of people, if this is slightly off topic, but when it comes to superhero movies,
sure.
I think a lot of what that director was saying about them, I didn't agree. I felt like some people get offended by the way the geek culture is represented in current pop culture. I know a lot of people, and I don't get it, but a lot of people really dislike Big Bang Theory because like they're making fun of us. And my feeling is if you see yourself in those characters, then the issue is with yourself. I'm like, I see it as a comedy. It doesn't bother me, and I can laugh along. I did have to say that I felt a little offended by the filmmaker that made Birdman, because it seems like in his world there can only either be serious film or frivolous film.
Uh-huh.
And to suggest that a career in frivolous film is a wasted career, I think is incredibly pretentious. And I don't think people are stupid enough to go to a frivolous movie and expect
great art.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great art and great moments that will be changing their perspective. There's nothing wrong with gut level entertainment. And I seek out both. I think Munich is a perfect example of that. I like challenging films and I like fun, entertaining films. And like I said, I just felt that, yeah, Birdman, I really think could have, much like Munich, achieved the same thing and lost a good half hour, if not 40 minutes. And I think it would have been a great tight little hour of a movie.
Sure, yeah.
And I think it would have achieved the same thing.
Yeah. So we're getting sort of towards the end here in the narrative, and we have Eric Bana, and he's in full paranoia mode. After he meets this, what he thinks is a prostitute, it turns out it's another operative.
Yep.
But he has that, and that was the only real sequence where I was like, oh man, that was one of the more uncomfortable deaths. to watch her get those different shots and about how they are displaying her, essentially. And I was like, oh boy, like that's rough.
Yeah, I certainly remember being with my aunts and being like, oh God, bad,
right.
Bad choice, John. Bad choice. Right. The old ladies can't handle it.
They're like, oh, what happened to good little old Johnny?
Yeah, exactly. Not only that, and she's okay, but unfortunately my one aunt is currently suffering from Alzheimer's, and it was at the start of that period where she was becoming forgetful. Well, she remembered Munich, and she certainly remembered that I took her to see. Oh, that was horrible! And I'm like, yeah, great. That you have to remember.
That's the thing.
I certainly do. And I'm like, oh, God. So, yeah.
That's funny. So yeah, he has, he has this paranoid life, and he's beginning to, he's carving up his mattress and he's carving up his box springs and sleeping in the closet. And, this is where I feel like it maybe is a little bit easier to perform this way because he's so on one side now, but this is where it really struck me that damn, Eric Bana is really good in this, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
It was just like, this is the most showy, and this is like the, okay, well, I see what he's doing, and he's just playing desperate, and that's fine, but I just think that he's very good at it. And it was the sort of thing that hadn't seen him do much of, like we had mentioned in Hulk and some of his other performances.
Completely agree. No, absolutely, man. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, it's a hero, it is a hero's journey of sorts, but also it doesn't end well. And I mean, and that's the great thing is that, no, he is able to play this really kind of sad person that is really damaged from all this experience. And again, that's another reason why it impresses me as a Spielberg film, where it's like, no, there's not a happy ending here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the only guy that seems okay with himself at the end is Jeffrey Rush, obviously. Yeah. It's like, hey, you know, this is the game, pal.
Yeah. Ephraim's, he's the only one. He seems to be all right. I guess Papa and Louie, I guess, are okay.
Yeah,
exactly.
And certainly, you know, but that's the thing. Like you kind of take Ephraim as someone that, you know, you take him as, kind of a lieutenant that is trying to do the right thing. You've got, a woman who I think, by the way, and we didn't mention this, I forget the actor's name that plays Golda Meir, but it's one of the best portrayals of Golda Meir that really just shows her as a leader and not as the iconic figure that so many of her film portrayals have shown. I think, you know, they really show her just getting down to business.
Yes.
And being tough as nails. And I think that's awesome. And I really, really appreciated that. And like, you know, it just, Ephraim is one of those guys that you take at the beginning of, okay, we're doing this because it's the right thing to do. And when Bana is at that point of, I'm not sure what's right anymore, you know, Jeffrey Rush has made his peace with his lot in life a long time ago, and is like, look, you know, the only thing that's going to make sense is if you get back to killing more.
Yeah.
which is sad, but it, like, essentially embrace this reality that we've thrown you in, and that's the only way that you're really going to be able to make peace with it.
Yeah, and that makes sense. I mean, I think I'm a bigger fan than most of The Hurt Locker. And that's a similar,
I love that movie. Yeah, I love that
similar
movie
sort of character there.
Absolutely.
And so I can appreciate that. I do think, I don't know. I think that Spielberg is a little on the nose with the way that he chooses to do the helicopter explosion and the executions, though. I don't know that it necessarily has to be when he's having sex with his wife.
Well, dramatic license.
Yeah, it strikes me a little bit as, Zack Snyder in the Hallelujah sequence in Watchmen.
What's the Hallelujah sequence?
Where Jeff Buckley's singing Hallelujah and they're having sex. Owlman
I totally forgot that's what was happening.
Yeah, they're having sex and they're playing Jeff Buckley's Hallelujah in the background.
Oh, when the explosions are? Yeah, I guess so. Yeah,
it's where they're in the suits so then they can perform. It's very on the nose.
I didn't recognize Jeff Buckley as the artist at that. Yeah. Or I didn't remember that particular song while they were doing it. That's very funny.
Yeah, so that's what they're doing. And so that struck me as the same sort of thing. I mean, obviously the time doesn't work out there, but it struck me as the same sort of deal to where it was like, okay, well, you know, he's having sex and we're having this sort of revelation. It just was like, I don't know, it was a film where of all the things that they were doing that were not typical, this was one of the few that felt typical.
Well, like I said, that was my problem with the Papa conversation
too. Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, that's the thing. It's, you know, and again, that's, you know, I said it earlier too. It's not a perfect movie. I mean, there's a couple nicks here and there, but it's ambition. I appreciate its ambition.
Sure. And, well, if it's perfect, what is there to talk about, right?
Well, hey, man, I don't know. God, In Bruges, I think, is a pretty perfect movie. Mm. I think, God, what was another one that just, like, I forget who I was talking about, but it was one of the comic creators that I have on Word Balloon that always wants to talk about screenwriting and stuff. And it was like, In Bruges is so perfect. I mean, everything goes back to everything that's laid out there comes back and is explained in the story and stuff. And it really is a kind of perfect script. And it's, I mean, there's another example of what's his name?
Colin Farrell.
Colin Farrell. Thank you. Yes. Colin Farrell is.
I wanted to say Colin Firth at first.
That's funny. I kept thinking like Colin Ferguson, and I'm like, no, that's not it. Not at all.
Colin Ferguson.
You know, Craig's ne'er-do-well brother. You know, I don't know. But, Colin Firth was great in that movie, and I can't see anybody else playing it. The few things that, like we said, are cliche, for lack of a better word, I can forgive Spielberg for those.
Sure.
I
mean, of course.
And again, yeah, I mean, that's the thing. This is a master, and I think it's a master that really tried to stretch himself with this movie.
I think he did. He did very well at his attempt. I mean, obviously he's as successful as it gets, right? But I do like when he sort of pushes the limits a little bit. And I think that, you know, I hope he has something like Munich coming up. You know, I hope he does.
Yeah, I agree. Well, that's, you know, Red Tails for Lucas. That was my hope with Red Tails. Because I had heard Lucas talking about the Tuskegee Airmen for years. And that he's like, you know, when I finally get done with Star Wars, one of the things I want to do is a story about Tuskegee. And it's like, that's fantastic. And then he finally gets to do it, and it's like, oh, all right. You know, but I don't hate it as much as I think other people do, but it's unfortunately not as good as I had hoped it would be.
Sure.
But that's the thing. I think interesting filmmakers, when they do for lack of a better word, passion project. I don't know. I'd like to hear Spielberg say, I assume, again, coming from the same place as Schindler's List, because it is such an important Israeli story. I don't know if he had a direct connection to it or what, but, it would be interesting to hear his reasons why he wanted to make the film. And again, I don't think it would be that easy of a sell. And because of his clout and position in Hollywood, I'm glad that he is able to make this kind of movie and then get back to the stuff that's going to make, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars and, you know, everybody's
sure. There. Yeah. Cause I mean, he went very dark and serious with this. And then after that, he did, he went to, going back to doing the more crowd pleasing. Well, the attempt to crowd please with Indiana Jones was after this.
Oh, really? Last Crusade or
Crystal Skull? Yeah.
Hilarious.
And then
hilarious.
he did the motion capture Tintin, and then he did War Horse and Lincoln, and so his next film.
Hey, look, you know, all right, let's look what's come since. With the exception of Indiana Jones, there's been a lot of, like, you know, War Horse certainly isn't, you know, an obvious choice. Lincoln, I mean, you know, and I liked Lincoln a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I have to confess, I didn't see War Horse.
War Horse, it was a lot of, Spielberg.
Well, there you go.
Like, you know, it's like all of his bad cliches that you'd think of.
Okay.
But, all right. Well, but
that's kind of what it felt like from the trailers and stuff.
Yeah, I am excited for this year, though, in his next film, which is yet to be titled, but it's supposed to be a fall release, and it, reunites him and Tom Hanks. And it is, it's a Cold War spy thriller.
Oh wow! Anytime it's a Cold War spy thriller, immediately has my attention. World War II as well. I haven't seen the Cumberbatch Enigma film.
Oh, yet. I just saw that about a week ago.
How was it?
You know, it's not very daring. That's for sure.
How does it compare? And I'm guessing you remember this, the Doug Ray Scott movie from about 10 years ago.
Yeah,
or
it's
15 years ago.
I would say I think Cumberbatch is very, very good. I think that. They don't the sort of homosexuality is just sort of tossed in, kind of.
Okay.
Which I don't know. I guess I could kind of take or leave. They just sort of, I don't know. It just seemed very, very safe to me. And I don't understand the Keira Knightley, Golden Globe buzz about her winning about her getting nominated for Best Actress. Like, I don't get that at
well,
all.
Well, the Hollywood Foreign Press, they do their own thing. And yeah. Really, the Globes are, it's more about the party.
Sure.
It really is. And I mean, and a lot of, like, there have always been a lot of, like, left field nominations that it's just, yeah, but we like her.
Yeah, I think she's good, but she frankly doesn't have much to do. I mean, she's, if it was anyone other than Keira Knightley, who's considered one of your pretty actresses, and just kind of a action star sort of a actress.
Uh-huh.
If it was anyone that has, like, what I would call weight as an actress, that can take on a big role. I think if that was them, it would go by unnoticed. But because it's her, like, if it was like a, I don't know, like an Amy Ryan or something, to where it's just like a character actor who's good and, who's been in like The Wire and what have you. If it was someone like her, they'd be like, all right, yeah, she was good in that.
I hear you. I think, Derek Jacobi played the same character, in the 90s on a BBC television film.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, because I wanted to learn more. And also, I am curious, and I know that the homosexuality part of the film is important because it's a point that Vivek Tiwari made in his graphic novel, The Fifth Beatle, about Brian Epstein, and is making in his film about it too, and the fact that beyond the fact that homosexuality was not was frowned upon. I mean, it literally was a crime still in England.
Sure, yeah, they do mention that. I mean, that is a. I mean, it's in the film, but it's just kind of a
side.
Yeah, it's just like, okay, well, he's in here, and this is why we're talking to him, because he was picked up for having a male prostitute with.
Got
him,
it. Okay.
And so that's why we're in the jail cell talking with him, and he's going to tell us his story.
Interesting. I do still want to see it.
It's good. It's well done. It's just, I think that it does not take very many risks. And it is, like when they show us a lot of the battle sequences and that those are all pretty, I don't want to say cheaply, but I can't think of another way to do it. They are pretty, unimpressive war sequences. It's like very clearly just something that's gives you enough information, but they didn't really spend the time and take the time to make like the CGI look good because they don't show a lot of, I mean, it might as well be been animated.
All right. Or maybe again, use newsreel footage versus.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. It was just kind of put in there and I don't know if they had a lot of thought to it and I just didn't enjoy what they did with it or if they just kind of was like, well, we can just put anything in here. It's the idea of what's going on.
I'm glad to hear that Spielberg and Hanks are getting back together.
Yeah, they're getting back together. And the film is written by Joel and Ethan Coen.
Oh, even wow. You see, this is what I'm saying. I these are the kinds of moves that I find intriguing when Spielberg does it. And that is very interesting.
Yeah, it's Joel and Ethan Coen, and it's also written by a gentleman named Matt Cherman, who worked on, I don't even know what these shows are. It's Man Stroke Woman, Our Zoo, and Black Work.
Haven't heard of any of them.
I guess he did an uncredited Polish of 2012.
Hilarious. Well, yeah, that's, boy, keep that in the,
I might want to bury that.
Yeah, exactly. Keep that off your IMDb list. it's weird though, The Terminal, I have to say, I had no interest in seeing it in the theater, but I did end up watching it on cable. And I liked it for what it was.
Yeah, that one's not my favorite.
I can appreciate that. No, and I know I'm in the minority, but I'm like, an interesting choice on Hanks's part.
Sure.
But yeah, I mean, that's like every now and then you got to be in the right frame of mind to see a movie that, guys are out of their comfort zone and women as well. And it's interesting when these choices happen. And that's why it's like, ooh, let's see what happens here. Or, Ebert always said that he didn't want to see remakes of movies that worked. it would be much more interesting to take a movie that didn't work and try and fix it.
Sure.
And there are plenty of those to go through. That's why I love Turner Classic Movies. There are dozens of films of A-list stars that aren't the classics that we all remember, but Turner shows them, and they aren't that good. Hmm. But they're interesting to watch because, all right, well, what went wrong in this Jimmy Stewart movie or William Powell movie? And it's so shocking to see them not succeed at the level that, you know, My Man Godfrey or, you know, the Mr. Smith Goes to Washington or something, just to name a couple obvious ones.
Sure.
You know, it's fun to see the two-star movies. And, okay, what went wrong? Like Carbine Williams is a good one of Jimmy Stewart's like that, where it's a very atypical role and he plays this very hillbilly kind of guy that was responsible for making the carbine rifle.
Okay.
And it's such a weird movie, and he's a convict and stuff, and it's kind of a hard character and not a typical Jimmy Stewart movie. So.
Interesting. Yeah, interesting. So I guess we talked about the end a little bit. What do you make when you walked out when you were when you initially when you initially walked out, what did you make of the end? Was it like I'm glad that it ended that way, or you're like,
I was glad it ended that way. I was honestly, like I said, I was expecting a Spielberg ending, and I got a very, like, no, this subject is a lot more complicated than that. And there are times that I am like, good. Yeah. And that's when I do step out of the narrative, and the critical mind of mine, like, steps up and says, good, thank you. Mm-hmm. Because how dare anyone think that this can be solved in even 2 hours and 45 minutes, and that it is, I was glad. I liked it.
Yeah. I will admit to when I first watched it going, oh shit, that's how it's going to end. And then kind of sitting there for a minute and I was like, oh, well, of course that's how it's going to end. You know, so I was, in the narrative in that, no, they can figure things out. Like everything. You know, you just need X to do Y and everything will be fine. But once you sort of step away from it and you realize what the film's trying to tell you, you're like, oh, okay. Well, of course it had to end that way.
Yeah. No, I did. I accepted it, I think, from the narrative standpoint as well, because I think at that point, the world showed how crazy it really is.
Yeah.
The subtext was, this world is too big for me to understand. And mm-hmm. Jeffrey Rush is saying, of course it is.
Yeah.
Don't think too hard. And it's like, well, I'm sorry. I can't help it. I'm a human being and I'm not as jaded as you are and haven't, you know, or gone past that moment of comfort in what I do to, holy crap, what am I doing? I'm not the person I used to be and I don't want to be this person that I am right now.
Sure. And I do.
And, you know.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, that's it.
Oh, I do like how they set up the breaking bread, right? They mentioned breaking bread earlier in the film, and they also have the one of the hostages that's killed who's cutting bread at the very beginning of the movie. So the very end of the film, it, you know, comes full circle, and they're talking about, will you break bread with me? And he says no, and he walks away. And I, you know, after thinking about it, I was like, God damn, that's perfect, because it's not like they're friends. It's not like the, right. Oh, we're in it together and we're going to take, you know.
Nope. Exactly.
It's not like that at all. It's much more cold and distant, and I really appreciated that he decided to end it in that way.
Well, and that's the thing. He has no, Jeffrey Rush is saying, come back to Israel. Come back to your life. You are of us. You are one of us. And it's not anymore.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, no, I'm not. And I don't belong in Brooklyn either. I mean, right. It's really, it is sad, but it's more real. And like I said, I always applaud the realistic, because I always like bringing it up. Tarantino says it was after Rocky. Rocky kind of brought back the notion of happy endings in movies again in 75. Because in the 70s, we really got to a point where movies were getting incredibly realistic and gritty.
Sure.
And very tough. And even though Rocky doesn't, you know, beat Apollo Creed, he does get the girl. And that, you know, you just get this feeling of, well, he's going to be okay.
Mm-hmm.
He's okay with himself and everything. And then he's kind of accepted who he is and you know, did something.
Yeah, that's such an interesting transition, that 70s to 80s, that gritty to blockbuster and all of that. You know, on filmographies, which is a different show that I do with Cameron Rice, we had our mutual friend Gabe Hardman on.
Love Gabe.
And Gabe and Cameron and I discussed William Friedkin is the filmmaker that we're in the middle of his filmography.
Fun.
And so we did The French Connection, The Exorcist, and Sorcerer. And so we talked quite a bit about how Sorcerer came out a week after Star Wars did.
That's right.
And it was your typical of the time 70s American film to where it was unrelenting and it's of an early 70s sort of nature.
Absolutely.
And then we have this blockbuster of Star Wars and it's in there for a week and they bring Star Wars back into the theater and they remove Sorcerer from the theaters.
Wizards fell victim to that too, the Bashki film. Go on.
Yeah, and so it's just interesting to think about people now, and you mentioned this with the gut entertainment thing, people now sort of rail upon films that make a lot of money, like your Transformers films. And that's not a particular franchise that I'm a fan of, but it makes a lot of money, right? That's the goal. They're not trying to make high art.
Right.
And right. You know, I don't think George Lucas was trying to make high art. He was trying to tell an adventure story based on the influences that he had.
Oh, no question.
You know, and so I think that there's room for both, but one is costs a lot more, and you know the general populace seems to be more attracted to. So
have you done with Friedkin or
no? Let's see. By the time this releases, we probably will be done, but we are as of recording on we are on the films. Oh, let's see. It is Rampage, The Guardian, and Blue Chips.
Okay.
Which is his late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah, yeah. No, I remember. Of course I remember Blue Chips being in sports radio and stuff.
Yes. Oh, Nick Nolte and Bobby Knight.
I love To Live and Die in L.A. It's a very 80s movie, and it's got a lot of Michael Mann kind of, you know, music video qualities to it.
Wang Chung.
Exactly, of course, absolutely. I still like it. I still think it isn't. I mean, God, that is when we all just said, "Who the hell is this Willem Dafoe, and when are we going to see more of him?"
Yeah, it's good. William Peterson doesn't quite have it figured as well as he did in Manhunter, I don't think.
I kind of am an acquaintance of Bill's, and I shame on me for even saying Bill, but we were friends in the late 90s, early 2000s when I worked at the Score. I haven't seen him in 10 years, but I'm sure if we saw each other, we would hug and laugh and immediately start talking like we always did. And it was always a pleasure talking movies with him. So he's kind of a bud where, like, I always root for Bill. And in fact, I like gave him, you know, crap about doing Fear
with Marky Mark.
Well, exactly, and being Reese Witherspoon's dad. And I'm like, dude, you're not supposed to be the dad. You're supposed to be the guy. What the hell's going on, man?
Oh, I remember that. Film. I remember seeing that when that came out. Oh, and that is not a good film.
No, it's not a good movie. And yeah, no, Bill's made a few bad movies. Don't get me wrong. But I really do like To Live and Die in L.A., and I like his transformation in that movie. And it's such a Chicago movie. He and Pankow. Our Chicago guys, Friedkin's a Chicago guy.
Sure.
And granted, it's the backdrop of LA and everything, but Chicago's all over the place in that film. And, I love it. I really do. And, I agree with you. No, Manhunter, he's certainly stronger in Manhunter.
Well, but, I mean, it helps that it wasn't his first film, you know? I mean, To Live and Die was his first one.
I guess his first lead, you're right.
Yeah, his first, yeah.
Cause he's in Thief even, you know, he's got a little throwaway role in Thief.
What do you think of Cruising? Friedkin's Cruising. Have you seen that?
You know, I have to confess that I never did see Cruising.
Okay.
I've never seen Boys in the Band for the same reason.
Oh, Boys in the Band is good.
And I've heard that. I love Pacino, and it just, I don't know. It just didn't, you know, and certainly at the time, I think I was 14 or 15, so it really didn't interest me when it was coming out.
Yeah, it is a mess. I mean, it is. Okay. It is an interesting mess. I liked it because of the discussion that comes out of it. But I can see where people can, I mean, it doesn't make a lot of narrative sense. It's confusing and complicated, and it seems like Friedkin maybe pulled a fast one on Pacino in the editing room, and that's why Pacino didn't promote the film. And, so it's kind of a disaster, but I think it's an interesting movie.
A different movie that I wonder if you explored it, because it was technically a Showtime cable movie, but his version of 12 Angry Men.
Oh, we're going to do that. Yeah, we haven't got to it yet.
Well, if you want to guess, I'd be happy to talk about it, because Bill gave me a lot of insight into that movie, and okay. I don't want to spoil it for our discussion now, but I really enjoyed it, and it was interesting to hear why that movie got made. I'm happy to tell it now if you want to.
Oh, great. Sure. Well, I mean, either way is fine with you. I mean,
well, I'm happy to do it again on the proper podcast when you're talking about the movie itself. But I guess Lemon was so, you always hear about, especially back then when, the actors had, they have them now too. They have their own production companies and were really, you know, chasing down books or plays to adapt. And obviously it had been on television, first, 12 Angry Men, even before, the Lumet movie. Mm-hmm. And in fact, Franklin Schaffner, the guy who directed, Planet of the Apes and Patton, among other great films,
sure.
was the TV director. Fonda grabbed the movie before Jack Lemmon had a chance to get it. And that just stuck in Jack Lemmon's craw literally for the next 40 years.
Mm.
Or 35 years, however, because it was from the 50s to the 90s between the two versions.
Yeah, 40 years, yeah.
Yeah, and so, you know, it is amazing that Lemmon is like, we're making this damn movie, you know, all right, fine. And also the amount of stars that he got to do in the new version.
Yeah, big cast.
Good God. And I mean, you know, George C. Scott was kind of at that period, and I don't mean this to dismiss guys that made these choices, where he just wanted to work.
Sure.
And so he was great in the Lee J. Cobb role, and there are...
Well, Tony Danza, shit.
I was going to say, obviously, Tony Danza.
James Gandolfini's in it.
That's the thing. And Peterson is in it, and Courtney B. Vance.
So say we all, Mr. Edward James Olmos.
Indeed. I mean, that's the thing. It's God, and he's such a great actor. Mm-hmm. I love that guy. I got the chance to interview him.
Oh, Mary McDonald as well.
Mary McDonald's in 12 Angry Men?
She's the judge.
I totally forgot that.
I didn't realize that at all. That is hilarious.
God, that is such a token-like moment, because really it all does take place in the jury room. But that's the thing. No, I think every version of 12 Angry Men that's been filmed is interesting. And it's a challenge from it being such a close, small set movie and everything. But, and at the end of the day, it's a by the numbers TV movie. But I really do like it more for, just the backstage stuff that Bill told me. And he was just giddy. And he's like, this is fantastic. He goes, you know, I'm making a movie with Jack Lemmon and George C. Scott. This is insane.
Yeah.
And he was so thrilled. And he's like, and he told, cause he and Friedkin were buddies and stuff. And when he heard he was doing it, he's like, I'll do anything. I'll do any role you want me to do. And I think he had Robert Weber's role. I think he's the ad man. He's the advertising guy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty sure. But yeah, I love, I love it. And I love comparing it to both. You can watch the TV version on YouTube of 12 Angry Men. And Robert Cummings is in the Henry Fonda Jack Lemmon role. Cause that's the thing, like Lemmon and Courtney B. Vance, it seemed kind of, they split the Fonda role because Lemmon was, to be fair, a little too old.
Right, sure.
I mean, it could, you know, whatever. He's just a conscientious objector in that, you know, group. So we're way off topic, but anyway.
No, that's fine. But on that episode, what we'll be covering, Jade, which is streaming on Netflix.
okay. Well, David Caruso?
I believe it's Linda Fiorentino, I think is the it is David Caruso and Linda
Fiorentino. Yeah, I thought so. Okay.
And Chaz Palminteri.
Danny Aiello, I just heard him like Breaking Bad on David Caruso on Gilbert Gottfried's podcast, and it was so funny.
Oh, I'm sure he's.
He said he's a wonderful guy, don't get me wrong, but that guy is a poser. He is not an actor. And it was so funny hearing him just very matter of fact. He's like, listen, I like the guy. He's a good guy, but he is not an actor. He's a reactor. All he does is, you know, he takes off his sunglasses for 2 seconds.
Oh, exactly.
That's the reaction. It's hilarious.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's Jade, 12 Angry Men, and Rules of Engagement are the three.
And that's the Samuel L. movie with
Samuel L. and Tommy Lee Jones.
And Tommy Lee Jones, yeah.
Guy Pearce. So you're not required to be there for all three. You could always just pop in and out.
I'd almost want to just talk about the. Although I never did see Jade, and I never did see Rules of Engagement.
Well, there you go. I know that Jade is streaming on Netflix, so that one's readily available. That one's easy to find.
And I, you know, anytime Tommy Lee Jones, I just like, I'll tell you what, slick. I immediately go to Brave Men in Black and stuff, and I just, you know, every movie. Because even he's pretty much playing that same role in Space Cowboys. Hey, to tell you, Frank.
He's that in almost, in almost everything.
Well, in the last 10 years. That's all right. You know, good for him.
Yeah, even in Captain America.
He's awesome.
He is very good.
No, that was perfect casting in Captain America. Yes. My God.
Yes, it was. All right. Well, John, do you have anything else about Munich before we
like I said, I think it's an awesome, complicated movie that isn't perfect. And those are the reasons why, if you're a Spielberg fan and haven't seen it, shame on you. You should totally go see it because it shows a side of Spielberg that he rarely gets to explore. And I think, It's a complicated movie in the best possible way that I think will make you think.
Yeah, I think I guess the way that I've been trying to describe it is it's complex and has a few moments that are complicated. Because I think complex is great. I think complicated is problematic.
Potentially, but again, it forces you to pay attention. And unfortunately, our attention span is getting shorter and shorter. But again, that's why it's like, no, you know, well, I would think movie people, you know, they want to be challenged. Yes. And I think, and so that's why it's like, all right, you know, you can't watch this while you're cooking. You have to, you know, really want to see it.
Yes.
And, you know, you'd be in the right frame of mind to kind of let it happen for you.
Yeah. But that's exactly what I was going to say. You have to be ready to watch it.
Yes. And it is. It's tough. It's a tough movie, but that's cool. And again, you know, this is from, like I said, the Hallmark card guy.
Yeah.
That man is to be really, really damn tough, and we forget how tough he can be.
Yeah, that's true. All right, well, I think that pretty much wraps things up. If you have any comments, suggestions, or movies that you'd like to hear us talk about specifically for Podshots, you can email us at plainlabelpodcast@gmail.com. You can follow the show over at Twitter. Our handle is @plainlabelpod, or you can follow me. I'm @ericwilliams79. We also have a Facebook page where you can like the show. Just search for Plain Label Podcast. And if you wanted to help us out a little bit, you could head over to Amazon.com and you could search for our wish list. It's full of the movies we want, equipment we need, and a whole host of other goodies in case you're in the giving mood. Just search for the wish list called Plain Label Podcast. So I want to thank Mr. John Suntress, again, for coming on and discussing the film with me. If people wanted to hear more from you on this show, they could check out our previous discussion back in the archives on The Lookout. But if people wanted to hear more from you or get in contact with you specifically, where could they do so?
You can come to wordballoon.com. That's where I do my weekly podcast, where I talk to comic creators, every now and then a television or movie person as well. And we cover the primarily, you know, what's going on in comics and comic-related media. But every now and then I throw a left turn, and I'll even do my own movie stuff on there, where I do the segment called Scene Missing with the aforementioned Gabriel Hardman and Hilary Barta, among others.
And Will Pfeiffer.
Will Pfeiffer, my guy, who I love. And,
yes, Will, yeah. Will's been a recent guest on here as well.
There you go. No, it's, you know, we're the guys that, you know, we're the creepy guys that like all the old movies. that they show on Turner Classic Movies and some of these other newer digital cable movie channels. Really quick, do you watch movies, or do you have access to any of these other commercial digital channels that they run old movies on these days?
No.
Okay, that's too bad. In Chicago, God, we're an embarrassment of riches because Weigel Broadcasting, the company that is behind MeTV and MeToo, they've got four or five other digital channels, and because it's Chicago based, we get them all.
Really?
And yeah, and I'll tell you, man, there's, this, and this seems to really go through the MGM library, but not, the obvious hits, really kind of the schlocky stuff that came in the 50s, 60s, and 70s.
Hmm.
And then there's the movies channel that seems to dip into Fox's stuff. And they do. They show hit movies, but they also show weird, obscure stuff like the 50-foot Bride of Candy Mountain or whatever it was called, Lou Costello's last movie without Bud Abbott.
Huh.
And a very weird movie. But a lot of times, you know, or just the worst Bob Hope movies that Bob made.
No, we don't get a lot of that in Lincoln. Nebraska, unfortunately.
I understand. Well, you know, I wasn't sure if what, you know, satellite or cable provider you might have, and you might have that stuff on there.
No, so. We don't have that fancy Comcast. We just have Time Warner.
I'm sorry, man.
Damn it. I'm missing out.
Turner Classic Movies will serve you.
Well, yeah. I mean, that'll do me right. Although, as of recording, it's literally about we're watching the movies for the recordings, and that's about the time that's allowed.
I can appreciate that. No, that's how I am with comics, with Word Balloon and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
I'll get her on, and it's like, oh boy, I better go deep in my Rick Remender if I'm going to have Rick on and stuff.
Better catch up.
Exactly.
All right. Well, thank you for listening, and we'll be back in 2 weeks with another co-host and another film.